The American justice system is a frequent focus of attention, and rightly so. No other country locks up as many people as we do, more than 2 million at a time, with as many questions about why they are there and why the incarcerated population runs heavily to people with darker skin. Our guest this hour has both the darker skin and the experience of being incarcerated. Ravi Shankar got locked up once incorrectly, another time was very much his own doing. He relates the incidents and his thinking in the book Correctional, a memoir. This Ravi Shankar is best known as a poet and a prolific one, with 15 books and chapbooks of poetry to his credit as either writer or editor. Ravi is a Pushcart Prize winner. He's also taught writing at schools from Central Connecticut to Sydney. Ravi Shankar, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
It's great to be with you, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
It's a great line early in the book about what is the Tamil word for foobar. You have had quite the odyssey. Is this the first time you're addressing it in prose?
It certainly is, yeah. I've written a couple of op-eds about it, but this kind of book-length work, this is a first.
So you're born in the USA, as you point out, but of parents from India, an ABCD in some people's minds. What's an ABCD?
Well, a little acronym that stands for American-Born Confused Desi, and that's what Indians like to call us, bicultural immigrants, because we're kind of don't really know. We know a little bit about our culture, but we're also trying to be Americanized, and there's a sense of dislocation and exile, I guess, in our identity. And so a little bit of a mocking term with which we'd be called as a kid.
Yeah, definitely bicultural, but in your family, you get a quick sense in the book of what's right and proper being drummed into you very young. Your parents seem to really get the idea of what would people think into you.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, you know, the mythical aunties over in India, I mean, what would they think? And it was my parents were, I was born in Washington, D.C., raised in Northern Virginia, and yet my parents wanted to have a kind of devoutly Hindu household. And as a young kid, I wanted to assimilate and be one of the regular boys, and yet also, of course, wanted to please my parents who loved me very much. And so that kind of initial conflict is certainly at the core of the story I tell.
Well, I was going to say, as the events of the last few years unfolded, I mean, that phrase must have come into your head quite a bit.
Oh, yes. You know, I mean, my parents, my mother still to this day, I can't believe that I wrote this book, because this is all stuff that happened nearly a decade ago, and that in South Indian culture, if something traumatic and painful happens, you repress it, you bury a hole and you dig it very deep and you push it down and never speak of it again. And so to kind of write this book, and it was very difficult, because when I was going through what I went through, I thought often of the effect on my parents, who, you know, had invested so much in raising me in what they thought was a proper way.
You developed your skills as a writer fairly young, it seems, but this is interesting. You won an essay contest for the United Daughters of the Confederacy?
Yes. You know, I was a young boy in Manassas, Virginia, you know, known for the battles of Bull Run and Lorena Bobbitt, not the most cosmopolitan place to grow up as a South Asian boy, and yet I was a voracious reader, and my parents kind of forced me in some ways to enter all variety of contests, from essay contests to poster contests. And so I actually thought Stonewall Jackson was quite a military tactician, and I wrote this essay and ended up winning the grand prize award. And I still remember this lunch and all of the septuagenarians in their bustles and their jaws just dropping open when I came up on stage to accept the award for this essay I'd written.
That is a priceless moment. From, you know, from that point forward, I mean, you know, yours is not the resume of a guy who ends up in jail twice, in fact. So let's start off with what happened the first time in New York City.
Yeah, you know, that initial arrest, and I lived in New York. I went to graduate school there. I detail in the book living through 9/11 there, and I felt very much like a New Yorker, and subsequently moved to Connecticut, where I was teaching at a university, and married. I had two daughters who were born there, and I was just at a literary event in the city with my cousin, driving home, actually right near 34th Street, Herald Square, and Macy's, right there. And I made a totally legal left turn, and I saw the flashing lights of the cops behind me, and I didn't know what I'd done, and they gave me a breathalyzer, which I passed, and then they told me that there was a warrant for my arrest, and shoved me up against the grates, put me in cuffs and in the back of a paddy wagon. And then the officer who did this turned to his partner and racially slurred me, which I had described in the book. Turns out that this actually was a warrant for a 150-pound Caucasian male. I'm 6'2 and definitely not Caucasian, and someone who had lived in my address previously, and that I was totally shocked, of course, when this happened. I was kept for 72 hours in central booking. There's a large subterranean incarceral facility under the streets of Wall Street. So while you're walking downtown Manhattan, you might not realize it's right under your feet. There are these men and women who are being held. And when this happened, of course, I was shocked. I came to find out that this was actually very common because I had been caught up in the stop and frisk policy from Mayor Bloomberg, which later was found to be unconstitutional, but under which I think 800,000 innocent New Yorkers, primarily people of color, were stopped and in some cases held. So I sued the city of New York and I won a very small settlement. I guess the NYPD has paid out billions in police misconduct suits over the years. But that first encounter with the law in a place that I considered my home, Manhattan, kind of the cosmopolitan center of the world, was really very shocking to me. And I think had a pretty profound effect.
Ravi, you mentioned suing the city of New York and getting a small settlement, but you also went pretty public with the arrest in New York. How?
Well, you know, when that happened and I was totally innocent, I was horrified. I wrote an op-ed in the Hartford Current. I was very kind of on a soapbox about what had happened to me. And, you know, this was a time, and particularly after 9/11, when people of South Asian descent were kind of being targeted. So I did some radio events, and I was really very public about it, which later would turn out to be a little case of hubris, I think.
Because everything kind of came back on you when you got arrested the next time?
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. And that certainly made the officers and the other people I dealt with not very sympathetic.
Talk about just some general trends in your behavior. We've talked about the pressure of the invisible aunties in India and what would they think. But you accuse yourself of some reflexive, thoughtless behavior over the years. What kinds of things did you do when you were angry or upset?
Well, you know, I mean, I think I attribute this in some way to feeling like I always had to wear a mask, that at home, in order to be a dutiful son, I had to project a certain image, and it was very different out in the world. In fact, I cultivated a more reckless persona as far from the dutiful Indian boy as I could, and, you know, do reflexive things, you know, do some shoplifting, and as a kid, we would trespass and skateboard in these houses that were being built. And I think I also had a certain opposition and defiance disorder in some ways. I didn't like when my father told me that I couldn't do things for no good reason. And I also always was a little subversive and suspicious of authority. And I think I also didn't really know how to integrate my identity in a healthy way. And so when these things would happen, I probably also was at times drinking too much and finding these kinds of escapes rather than really dealing with what was at the core of what I was feeling.
So you mentioned the drinking. That's part of the picture here. You're an adult now. You're married. You got at least one kid, if not two, heading for tenure at Central Connecticut State University, doing some things to endanger your happiness, apparently.
Yeah, I was actually already tenured at that point, but I was going to be going up for a full professor and a homeowner. And yet, you know, even though Connecticut is just 2 hours away from New York, might as well be a universe away. I mean, we were living
in... I went to high school in Coventry, so yes, I know it.
Yeah. It's a beautiful place, and I still have some dear friends there. But, you know, living in a tiny, homogenous town in Connecticut where I was half the population of color was me. There was another guy I would see occasionally. I think that I was really successful at a young age. It kind of happened easily in some ways, but I was still kind of unhappy at home. I had these trouble in my marriage, and I also was kind of being a little bit impulsive and heedless. And certainly all of that kind of exploded in my face in a very big way over the course of about 18 months in Sanskrit, where my parents' culture comes from. There's this phrase, adrishti, a kind of dark cloud that can kind of overtake you. And it almost felt during those moments that I was out of control with what was happening. I mean, a combination of my bad decisions and also bad luck kind of overtook my life.
Of all that, though, of all those things being said, though, and your own admittedly reckless behavior, I really did not expect one of the mechanisms of your demise to be, I want to go to a soccer game.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so, you know, I'm a lifelong soccer player. And yes, this was the first domino in some ways to fall, was that it was trying to order tickets for me and my friends. Had a kind of a pre-sale link to see Lionel Messi and the Argentinian national team play in the Meadowlands against the U.S. men's national team. And, you know, tried to order about a dozen tickets and instead ended up having my credit card charged for $20,000 worth of tickets that I didn't intend to buy. You can see my credit card statements, but there are these multiple charges that went through, and Ticketmaster wouldn't take them back, and neither would my credit card, and I ended up claiming them eventually as fraud, which is what I tried to resell the tickets, and unfortunately I wasn't able to. I sold them at a fraction of the cost. I actually went to the game with my friends. I hadn't really told them what happened, with my stomach in absolute knots, thinking, oh my God, I'm in this massive debt for this game. What am I going to do? And Discover, the credit card company, said, well, if you didn't intend to make these charges, what you can do is claim them as fraud. But of course, the moment I tried to sell them, I had claimed ownership of it. And little did I realize that actually would lead down this path.
Yeah, it's quite a path, too, as detailed in Ravi Shankar's book, Correctional, a Memoir. So at this point, you're facing fraud charges and things like that. What kind of time in prison were you looking for upon conviction?
Well, you know, the thing was, I just actually filed a little case with the central cops, and I told them exactly what happened, but omitted the fact that I tried to sell these tickets, and didn't think that it was actually a serious thing. And then when they finally came back out for me, this was a felony charge of over $20,000. I mean, I was looking at potentially 3 years in jail.
Wow. So that was not the only thing going on. There was, and what do you know, soccer ends up at the center of both of these incidents. Talk about the night of the soccer game playing with the team you played with and what happened there.
Yeah. So, you know, while this was happening, I was kind of put on academic leave at the school. And actually, you know, should have been a great time because I was being paid and not really having to work. But it was a desolate time. I was wondering what was happening. And I was out with my soccer team kind of celebrating, scored the winning goal, and was out drinking and had a little too much to drink and ended up getting into a car accident. I actually never did take a blood alcohol test, so I don't know, you know, I don't know if I was over the limit or not. But as a result, got my license suspended during the time where I was already under the limelight for this other thing that happened with the credit card.
So suspended sentence, suspended license, but the story goes on from there because you drove under suspension.
Yeah, so it really was a lot of heedless and thoughtless decisions on my part, which I totally own up to. But, you know, at that time, I had my license suspended for I think it was a 12-month period or something. And, of course, there's no mass transport in Connecticut. I was taking Ubers and things like that to get to work. And then sometimes I thought, I'm going to the grocery store. I mean, I can drive. And I ended up getting a flat tire. And while waiting on the side of the road for a tow truck, instead a state trooper pulls up behind me. And because my license is suspended and I'm on probation, it violates the probation, and I have this jail time suspended sentence hanging over my head. And as a result, I have to do 90 days of pretrial detention at Hartford Correctional Center maximum security facility in Hartford, Connecticut.
Which bears some discussion here. It's weird. Connecticut hasn't actually had counties as governmental units since 1960, and so this is actually a state facility. Is that right?
Oh, it's a state facility. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So give us a description. So you've given up your freedom, by this agreement. You got a body cavity search. You got your jail clothes. I mean, once you got to turn your eyes into the facility you were entering, what'd you see?
Well, I mean, that whole process of being turned into a carceral object, and I should just say my sentence was a little different in that my attorney negotiated these 90 days, and I had really not been convicted of anything, but I would hear this phrase, a nefarious sounding phrase, to satisfy the state. And so I had to do these 90 days, but they were split up over about a year and a half, and so I actually had to do this 90 days over about five different stints. Certainly each time that you have the prisoned hands and you have to bend over and cough and you're jeered at, and then you're brought into this environment with a group of men that you've never met before, it was really very different than I expected. I wasn't in a cell. I think most of my visions of jail had been watching Prison Break or other shows as a kid. And I was in a dorm with 60 other men. There were dorm A and dorm B, so 60 men on the other side, 120 men, and mainly, I would say, 90% men of color. And you are on these bunk beds, and the space that the six beds make is your cube. And so you spend a lot of time with your cube mates and essentially trying to pass the time, telling stories, playing cards. That first stint, which I write extensively about, I was there at Hartford Correctional for 45 days, and really got to know the men around me.
We're talking to Ravi Shankar about his book, Correctional, a memoir about his encounters with the criminal justice system in the United States. You can join the conversation on The Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We kind of brushed past this earlier in the discussion, but I want to come back to it about the media splash that came with you getting in trouble with the law in a case that really was your fault. And then talk about the things that got written about you or said about you in this case after you had made a splash with time on NPR and op-eds in the Hartford Courant about getting arrested wrongly in New York City.
Yeah, so it was as if I was getting my just comeuppance in some way. And it was, of course, only a misdemeanor that I was eventually convicted of in. Yet there's not a lot that happens in Connecticut. And so the Hartford Courant, I think, published no less than 8 or 10 articles about me. I was on the evening news. Actually had news vans outside of my house where my daughters were waiting to go to school. And it became this media circus. And in part, I would come to realize most of this happened at the tail end of this time that I was going to be serving, because I was going up for promotion to full professor that very same year, and it was a fait accompli. And I'd already, all of my evaluations and publications had exceeded expectation, and it had been signed off on by everyone from the chair to the deans to the provost and the president, and just needed a rubber stamp from the Board of Regents, who was, of course, appointed by the Democratic governor. And so a Republican senator turned Hartford Courant columnist got a hold of this news. And that really made it. I was a political football in this case. And how dare they appoint someone like me to shape the minds of impressionable young people? How dare they? All of this kind of pseudo-moralistic rhetoric I got caught up in. And it really turned my life and my family's life totally upside down.
Well, you admit it yourself. You'd blown up a lot of stuff, though. I mean, your relationship with your wife, who was not mentioned actually by her own name. I want to talk about that later. But you had a home with a wife and two daughters, and the relationship with now your ex-wife obviously didn't survive this. I mean, so by the time you settle into your first stint at Hartford Correctional, what comes to mind when you have a quiet moment? If you had a quiet moment.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of reflection, you know, and someone who, and I write about this, I think my story is a little unique in that I'm someone who's benefited immensely from systems of privilege all my life, and yet also someone who's been discriminated against because of the color of my skin. And to just kind of try to unravel how, in the midst of a successful life, I could have ended up in this space. I also spent a lot of time thinking of myself almost as an immersion journalist, kind of parachuted down into the space, taking as many notes as I could of the conversations happening around me, the legalese and bureaucratic forms that you had to fill out, the smells and odors and foods. I filled probably a dozen notebooks, which became some of the material that I used when I was writing correctional.
All right, so you did actually connect with the other men then. It was not like you were trying to hold back or anything, or just be an observer. You were living the life in there, such as it is.
Well, yeah. I mean, initially I wanted to disappear into the wall. I mean, I was just kind of terrified. But when you spend this much time around men, and I got to realize that you know, there are people I never would have met in my everyday life. Some of them might have had substance abuse issues or mental health problems. Some of them seem to me totally innocent, and others, of course, were guilty of some pretty terrible things. And yet, whatever they needed to help with was not being addressed in jail. And they shared stories, you know, when they found out, and I didn't want to tell them that where I taught or anything, but it was soon apparent that I was someone a little different than normally they would encounter in there. And I was called all variety of kind of colorful nicknames. I realized a couple of things as well, that I actually am better at basketball than I thought I was and worse at chess. You know, and so kind of ingratiating myself into that community. And it really is, I mean, these men, some of them are kind of hardened and have tattoos and scars, and yet you'd see them braiding one another's hair and cooking food together and trying to make this community in some way, knowing that when they got out, there wasn't a lot necessarily waiting for them. That probably be very difficult to reintegrate.
More difficult than for you, for example.
Wow, absolutely, yes. You know, I mean, in spite of everything that had happened to me, and, you know, I ended up eventually leaving my position and all of that, they came from in circumstances where, and this is where I think I saw the impact, the full impact of the criminal justice system, because they themselves might have come from broken homes where they had a parent who had served time. And the kind of ripple, the outward ripple of that, really, I mean, I didn't see. I mean, I'm a college professor, and one of the first things I did was volunteer to try to teach in the school, to do anything I could, and all those requests were ignored. I did end up, and I write about this, teaching an illiterate inmate to write his first words and to write his name, and he wrote his daughter's name. And it was one, for me, I've taught at the university level for 20-odd years, and this was one of the great teaching moments of my life to connect with him in that way.
There was no library at Hartford Correctional, and there had been. Why was it closed?
Well, you know, the official reason I was told is that inmates were researching their cases, and they were using the library to kind of clog up the system. And yet, you know, in the 70s, there was a lot of kind of creative writing programs and arts programs, which have been found to be therapeutic. I'm a big believer in bibliotherapy, and that if you're able to express your ideas and have a chance to educate yourself, you're less likely to reoffend. However, at Hartford Correctional, I mean, there was always a list of books that were censored. In some cases, there would be pages in magazines, Men's Health, pages 58 to 64, was not allowed. It always made me interested. What was in there? You know? So there was a lot of kind of censorship in there. I mean, you know that your correspondence is being read, your phone calls are being listened into. And to also take away the library seemed pretty extreme to me.
You were just talking, Ravi, about the teaching. One of your proudest moments teaching was teaching somebody to write his first words, because there he was in Hartford Correctional, not ever having learned how to write. Give us a broader sense, though, of the educational level of the people in there, or basically the things that had happened to them. What got them diverted from, in most cases, finishing high school and ending up in the kinds of lives they ended up in?
Well, you know, there's a wide spectrum of men I met. One case comes to mind, Donnell, who I met, who's a young man who was going to night school for accounting, and had been arrested for smoking a joint, and it had a cash bond placed on him. It wasn't a large amount, but 10 grand that he couldn't meet. And so he'd been in there for longer than I had, for about 7 months, waiting for his court date, which kept getting continued. And in that time, he missed the birth of his first child. He, of course, flunked out of school. He didn't know what was waiting for him on the other side. There were other people who had some violent felony charges and gun charges. A lot of people who had drug charges as well. Many of these men had had an early encounter with the criminal justice system, it seemed, as a young man or as a teenager, and that ever since they found themselves back in. And they almost felt like it was a cyclical thing, that they had been a priori stigmatized as criminal, and they were always kind of going to be reoffend. I did meet a couple of homeless gentlemen who actually looked forward to being incarcerated, especially in the winter, because they knew that they would have a place to sleep and three meals, as meager and poor as they were. I met someone who had a PhD and was doing some pharmaceutical fraud of some kind. And so it really was a wide variety of men, but primarily working class, inner city people of color, that is who I met in Hartford Correctional.
Anne in Ashland sent an email. She says, thanks for your sharing here. What would you first change about the American system of incarceration?
Oh, wow. Well, I think the problem is, and when you look at the statistics, I mean, if you're a black man, you're five times as likely to be incarcerated. In the U.S. has 25% of the world's prisoners, while it only has 5% of the world's population. So I think that we historically have to look at our kind of puritanical zeal for punishment and what it costs. In Rhode Island, where I am now, it costs close to $75,000 a year for each incarcerated person. And so could that money be better spent? Could our taxpayer money be better spent on a system that statistically has been shown that we have some of the highest rates of recidivism of any country in Europe or otherwise? And so it's a pretty broken system. And it also has this kind of systematic racism on every level, not just policing, but also in the legislation of cases, on the length of sentences. And so I think the first thing is to really kind of reorient ourselves to whether this system is working at all, and to get people in power who can start to dismantle it. I mean, the difficult thing is that some of these roots were planted back in the 18th century, right? And so they're deeply embedded in the way that we think about ourselves, our communities. But I think that if we look at closely at whether it's effective and whether we can do a better job, our answer is pretty clearly yes.
Well, and people who run for office tend to, brand themselves as law and order candidates. I want to see more people locked up. We get three strikes laws, all that sort of stuff. You also get the people who say, well, look, they committed a crime. They did something wrong. They need to go there. You're somebody who by his own admission, messed up, needed to pay a price for it, but also has been greatly educated, unlike a lot of the people you were locked up with. And so put those together in a mix and tell us what maybe this indicates as an approach.
Well, I think certainly, I mean, there are certain violent offenders who probably need to be away from society. And then there are others who I think through the use of therapy and community service could more easily be diverted. And especially once they've paid their debt to society, when they then encounter so many obstacles to being able to reintegrate into a community, it's no surprise that they end up reoffending. And, you know, there's some great, I'm thinking of Jimmy Santiago Baca, who's this other who's illiterate, who turned into a dramatist and a writer through the California prison system, which had a great library at that time. And so I think helping these men and thinking about them more compassionately, because we are really connected. And so as a society, if we're spending all of this money on something that's not really facilitating any kind of real transformation. And that rhetoric that you mentioned of public safety and law and order, it's important to remember it's not just a kind of a Republican or Democratic thing. In fact, Bill Clinton's omnibus crime bill exacerbated a lot of the problems that exist in the criminal justice system and why there's been this explosion. I mean, it's pretty recent. I think we forget that in 1980, there was 250,000 people in jail or so, and as of last year, there's something like 2.2 million, mm-hmm. right? So nearly 1,000% increase in the last 40 years of our lives, and are we any safer or better off?
You make some comparisons in Correctional between the caste system in India and racism here, and I should point out that while you were born in the United States, you did spend some time in India, spending time with relatives. What do you see in those comparisons?
Yeah, and I there's a chapter in there. I actually, in the middle of my life, lived in India for about 18 months and went to school there, and so got to know the system pretty well. And of course, Isabel Wilkerson has this great book, Caste, that also talks about this. But, you know, in India, there's this sense that if you're a lower caste, there's no way that you can actually ever get beyond it, and that there was also this bias against darkness. My aunts would have this skin whitening cream, My Fair Lady, that they put on themselves, and they would forbid me from playing cricket in the midday heat, which is the only thing I wanted to do with my cousins, because it would darken me. And I think very similarly in the U.S., there's a way in which those who are we deem marginal in some way, the less fortunate, or those with mental health issues, or just from kind of pure racial animus, we are stigmatizing a certain segment of the population as lower caste. And that's kind of what Jim Crow was all about, I think.
Yeah, you mentioned there was something you said about the men that you spent time with. I mean, these are part of our society, and it's easy enough when you just shut them away to say, nope, they're not for now anyway.
And, I mean, it's not just not for now, of course, right? Because these men will eventually kind of come back out. And when you look again at the communities that they were raised in and the kind of educational system that they might have had, it seems to me that that's where we could maybe address some of these problems. Certainly, the prospect of going to jail wasn't going to deter the men that I met. That wasn't something that they were kind of afraid of. They'd been in and out of there. But why are they continuing the cycle? And can they be helped? And then the effect that it's having on the women and children that they're leaving behind, all of that, I think, has to be taken into account when we're thinking about reform.
Ravi, as you point out in the conclusion of the book, after the events behind bars, there was a public accusation of an unwanted kiss from you from years earlier. You chose not to remain silent. How did you take it, and what happened?
Well, yeah. So after coming through all of this, you know, and I spent some time in Australia. I got my PhD there, and spent a lot of time kind of writing this book. I was been in therapy and. I have a new partner now in beautiful house in Providence, and out of the blue, this poet wrote this essay where she accused a dozen men, naming them with their first name and last initial in this essay of some kind of sexual harassment. And of course, in the poetry world, you might not know who Don F. or John F. Z. is, But Ravi asked, it was pretty clear, and it's something that I didn't. She said that I kissed her in the middle of a crowded hotel lobby in the mouth and turned and left, and that it was an act of sexual assault. And so I responded, I didn't really remember it. And it was a mistake on my part because as soon as I responded, I was accused of gaslighting, of all of these different things. And it further made me kind of canceled from the one community that I felt most supported by, my literary peers. And so I do kind of write about that as well. And especially being the father of two daughters and a staunch feminist, what that kind of accusation, the effect it had on my life.
So the ways we treat each other in society, I mean, what do you find a common thread between the carceral state and the things you encountered with that harassment incident?
Yeah, I think that we're in a moment of outrage and we're very kind of inflexible and unforgiving and polarized. And it seems to me, and certainly my exposure with these men has just deepened my empathy in a big way. Certainly, I think it's made me a better educator. And it's made me realize that we really are all connected. And so to kind of throw someone out or outcast someone is ultimately not as effective as radical empathy and trying to kind of understand them and to feel compassionate for them and not to feel that their well-being is at the expense of your own, but that, rising tide lifts all boats.
You did try to get back in touch with the men you knew at Hartford Correctional. How did that go?
Well, and I'm still, this is an ongoing effort because I really do want, especially the men I wrote about, to have a copy of this book, you know. But unfortunately, the letters I wrote have gone unanswered. The inmate numbers I have, who knows? I mean, I know these letters, they get shuffled off. Some of these men from facility to facility had a couple of phone numbers, and those are not working. And so, as of now, I haven't had a chance, but I will certainly send a couple of copies to Hartford Correctional. I don't know if they'll make their way into the population, but this is a book I think that those who are on the inside, I would really like to have a chance to read.
I mentioned earlier on that your ex-wife, the mother of your two daughters, is called only Parker in the book. Why?
Well, you know, she, of course, is still in my life. She's the mother of my daughters and really did not want to be written about. And that's one of those things that you don't really negotiate as a poet, but that when you're writing a memoir, you have to. There are people who don't want to be particularly written about, but of course, she was an important part of my life. And so I wanted to respect that wish. And so I didn't include her as fully in some ways. And I also changed her name simply as a sign of respect.
Mm-hmm. Because she looks like Mary Louise Parker. Is that the reason for the
She was told that she looks like the actress. And so that's why I call her Parker.
So, Ravi, there is a letter directly to her in the book. I'm still saying, you know, dear Parker. She's just one person, clearly, on a list of people to make amends to. How goes the progress more broadly?
Good. And I'm glad you mentioned that because that's one of the architectural details of the book is that I have these six letters. And in India, there are six seasons. There are two additional seasons to the four we have here, the monsoon, the season of heavy rain, and the pre-vernal that comes before spring. And so I use those as a template to write these six letters to people in my life that I might have harmed in some way and trying to make amends. And I'm in a good place. I'm living in Providence. I teach at Tufts University, and I have a partner and two dogs. I'm not far from my girls, and what I've seen, I can't unsee. And so I think I've become a lifelong advocate for criminal justice reform and for kind of trying to make a more positive change. And so all of that is going good. And, of course, it's been very exciting to see the reception Correctional has been getting. That it's actually reaching a lot of people and starting a lot of great conversations like this one.
A lot of twists and turns in the book, that is for sure. It's called Correctional, a Memoir, the work of Ravi Shankar, who's previously been known as a poet, but this is all prose. Ravi, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a real pleasure, Jeff. Thanks so much for having me.
You bet. Take care.